So, how's that sports ball team?
Hey, sports ball.
Go sports ball. I've got no idea. I had no waffle in mind
What the hell are we talking about?
to start this.
This is what I live with. This is what I live with. Oh my God. And cats. And cats now. And
Yes,
cats.
cats. So if
And.
you want to see the cats, because we are actually live streaming our recordings now exclusively for Patreon
Are we doing this
supporters.
the whole time now? I'm freaking
I thought we could. Why not?
out.
That's a bit of fun. Look, we're going to be focusing on reading soon.
Okay, all
So,
right,
yeah.
okay. All right, yes, it's fabulous. Yes, we are still here.
Yep.
We have not gone away. Obviously, we
That's
have not gone away.
been a while since we recorded.
Yes, I know. And
But,
yeah, but
yeah.
things,
Things.
you guys know what's happening in the world at the minute. And yeah, things,
There's
just things, yeah,
just so
just
many
things.
things. So many things.
So many.
So let's stop talking about the things
And do the thing.
and do the thing. So I remember I'm going to put a pause in so I can know where to put the theme song. And then, yeah.
What the?
History.
Hello and welcome to What the History, your podcast where you get two bits of bizarre history to make you say, What the History? I am Trevor Holland and I'm joined by the ever gorgeous.
Oh, you're so kind. Susie Holland. Yay! This is our podcast. Welcome to What
Yay!
the History.
Woohoo!
Random
Excellent.
shit that's happened in the past and stuff that is interesting, sometimes funny, sometimes maybe not as funny, but always things to make you say, what the? What the? Or sheer exasperation.
Well, what the do you have for us this time around?
Okay, all right. We humans like our celebrations and our rituals. The celebratory birth of a child, weddings with the accompanying bucks and hens parties, birthday celebrations to mark the passing of the years, anniversary to mark the wedding dates with a particular object given as gifts. Trev, ours this year is copper, next year it's silver plate. But just giving you some ideas, silver plate.
Very subtle.
But the occasion that, in my honest opinion and humble opinion, has the most rituals and sometimes celebrations attached to it is death. Now, I know this is a somber subject, but it is a what the, okay? So I'm not going to giggle as much as I usually do.
Not around
I'm
it.
going to try not to because it is, it's, never mind.
Okay.
The wearing of black to show the world that we're in mourning has been part of us since ancient Roman times, when people in mourning would wear a woolen garment called a toga pulla in colours such as dark blue or black instead of wearing the white adult male toga, named the toga virilis. At times when the Romans wanted to protest a decision made in the Senate, they would also wear the toga pulla in mourning of their own choice. I thought that was really cool as well to show that they are not exactly happy. In medieval times, those in mourning would wear black, and women wore a black cap with a black veil to show their husband had passed away. Social etiquette in mourning dictated the refusal of social gatherings, and this brings to mind the scandal that had Scarlett O'Hara at centre when she dared to dance with Rhett Butler wearing her widow mourning attire in the film Gone with the Wind. Oh,
Shocking.
it's shocking. I remember her little feet dancing under the table when she was at the kiosk because she wanted to get out there. And then she went to hell with it and off she went. Okay.
Yep, she didn't give a damn.
No, she did not give a damn. And neither did Rhett at the end of it anyway, but that's a different story. And of course, there was etiquette directed at how long one needed to wear mourning attire. For a widow in Western countries in the 19th century, the mourning attire was full black. Black dress, long black veil, black gloves, black bonnet, black boots, and black accessories such as bands. The mourning period a widow had to observe, lest she be seen as immoral, and thereby throwing the whole family name into disrepute, was a year of heavy mourning and 12 to 6 months of half mourning, where colours like grey and mauve could be added to the mourning attire. Children of the deceased were mourning attire for a year after the death, with the girls' dresses usually mirroring that of their mothers. The widowers or men whose wives were deceased, they got off lightly. Typical. And only needed to wear a black armband or a black hatband. Coloured shirts were replaced with white. And they didn't have a mourning time, as mourning or showing emotion was seen as unmanly, and they were encouraged to get up back out there in the dating game, as their new wives would provide companionship and caring of the children. If a man didn't remarry, he was treated the same as a bachelor, and unmarried women could only associate with him in the presence of a female relative of his, and married women could only be around him if her husband or brother was present. Well, you might be thinking, dear listener, that this isn't very what the history. But hell, yeah, it is what the history. But what if I told you that the clothes the widow women wore in the 19th century could and did make them follow their husbands to the grave? And I'm not talking about the tight corsets, though, of course, that could happen too. Remember when I gave the description of the mourning clothes? Well, that material that all the mourning clothes were made from was a fabric called crepe. Pronounced the same way as the material crepe, but spelled C-R-A-P-E, as opposed to the other spelling of C-R-E-P-E. The A to signify the difference between the two fabrics, one for mourning and one not for mourning. And this fabric could kill. Fabric was, and I quote, matte gauze silk that had been crimped with heated rollers, dyed black and stiffened with gum, starch or glue, end quote. Societal demands of the day dictated that mourning clothes could not be able to reflect light, so the fabric was dull in shade, and because manufacturers of crepe advertised it as the ideal mourning fabric, they were able to use scrap silk and create a markup in the price, with silk manufacturers Courtaulds being the main supplier of the fabric, exporting it to the US, Canada and Australia. And of course, it was bad luck to have crepe in the house after the mourning period was over. So every time a death occurred, unless heaven forbid it was within a 2-year mourning period, a whole new black wardrobe needed to be purchased, set completely made of crepe. Some women would dye their clothes black themselves in their washing coppers. A manual on social etiquette, authored in 1884 by Mrs. John Sherwood, wrote that crepe was a most costly and disagreeable material, easily ruined by the dampness and dust, a sort of self-mortifying dress, and very ugly and very expensive, end quote. So when the woman sweated or it rained, the dye would run into the skin, and because black patches could only be removed, not with soap and water, but with a mixture of oxalic acid and cream of tartar, which was poisonous. The long crepe veils would also scratch against the face of the wearer, causing eczema-like facial eruptions. The veil was made of two pieces of crepe fastened by pins at the back of the bonnet, which made it difficult for the wearer to see through. One can only imagine, if the veil got wet, what it would do to the eyes. In the early 19th century, substances used to dye the crepe to the traditional black were plant-based, such as valonia, oak galls, or logwood. The valonia acorns and the oak galls have a high tannin content. Oak galls are parasitic formations found on oak trees, and logwood is made from the heartwood of the Central American tree and contains the chemical hematoxylin, which can cause respiratory, eye, and skin problems when ingested through the skin or lungs in high amounts. The mordant or dyset compound was made from acromium, which, if it is inhaled as dust, can cause pulmonary problems. It gets better and better for these poor women. A substance was also used in the dyeing of the fabric was bichromate of potash, or potassium dichromate, which in high amounts can cause skin and mucous membrane irritation. By 1870, scientists were synthesizing aniline dyes made from coal tar. To create the traditional black, benzene was derived from the coal tar. This itself is toxic, but when it's mixed with potassium dichromate and copper chloride, this takes me right back to chemistry days. Creating a deadly cocktail which could cause irritation to the skin, eyes and mucous membranes. Aniline dye could also be made with arsenic, and the arsenic could stay in the finished crepe. ending up with being 2-3% arsenic by weight.
Oof.
Therefore, arsenic poisoning could and did occur, as in 1874, British surgeon Jabez Hogg wrote of a patient with arsenic poisoning attributed to her mourning clothes. The medical fraternity were alarmed by the amount of cases of various mourning dress sicknesses that they were treating. In 1898, a doctor wrote in the Dietetic and Hygienic Gazette, and again I quote, "Many a woman has been laid in her coffin by the wearing of crepe. It is a sin to wear or do anything that hurts the health, and therefore I think it's positively sinful to wear mourning," end quote. Yay! Good on you, sir. Good on you. The folds of the fabric would rub together when it was moved and release various toxic chemicals into the air and into the woman. By the 1890s, public views had shifted and the sales of crepe plummeted when it was known how dangerous it was and how many orphans there were. Between 1883 and 1896, Coulthard's sales dropped 62%, and by 1894, they were making coloured silk. By the 20th century, mourning standards became more freer and no more crepe. Yay!
Yes.
Now, people, especially women in Western countries, are free to mourn the way that they want to, not cover themselves in clothes that can be fatal. So I actually held off on that story for a really, really long time. I wrote it back in January, I believe. And because of COVID and with so much death around, I decided not to release it until much later on. And I've still got a bit of qualms about releasing it, but I think it's important that the information's out there. It's horrible. First, the woman loses her husband. Then she has to wear this horrible stuff that could potentially kill her as well, make their children orphaned. And if she didn't do it, her family name would be in the mud.
That's just absolutely...
It's disgusting.
Ridiculous.
It's offensive as a woman. As a human being, that is offensive.
I mean, I know we keep talking about these things that they used to be and just how...
It took so long for them to make the connection between the clothes and the sicknesses and... When they worked out, there was so many orphans. Beggars belief. But, you know, they didn't know everything that we know now. But there's still not any excuse. They were working stuff out like this way back when. But
for a very long time. But it's
a woman.
Poisonous.
It's a woman thing, isn't it?
I mean, the
if it was affecting men, there would have been a massive outcry.
We are very happy here at What the History that time has moved on and this rubbish doesn't happen anymore. But it's just like,
But it may still be happening somewhere in the world. Really.
I mean, it'd be a wonderful, wonderful world if everyone was treated equally and respectfully and not forced into wearing or doing things that aren't good for them.
Exactly.
So, you know what? Yeah, we have nothing but the greatest sympathy for these poor women and their families back in the day. And for anyone that is still suffering under these sort of conditions, you know, we hope that you get out of it ASAP.
And we see you.
Yes. Yes, we do.
And we're trying to get the story out there. Like I said, this thing might still be happening around the world.
Yeah, not only with crepe, but with...
Not with crepe, but with other things.
We do know there are people out there working in terrible conditions and just basically being exploited. It's sad to say, but slavery still exists. So, you know, hopefully everyone keeps fighting the good fight and, you know, we can continue trying to make this world a better place.
Mm-hmm. And if we can do that through our podcast and through raising awareness, that's the thing that we can do.
Now, my story is very, very silly, so I am not going to do a silly segue from that.
No. Okay, so, forgive me, guys, but I believe that story was needed to be told.
Yeah, because, it's not the first time we've done the more serious ones. It's not going to be the last time either.
Yeah, it's usually about women.
Yeah.
Happy Warriors. One of my favorite stories ever.
Go with the Happy Warriors. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, Trev's got an interesting one.
I do. I do indeed. So, okay.
Okay.
When you think about famous criminals, key aspects may spring to mind. Dramatic shootouts, protection records, money laundering, the list seems endless. Yet there are some surprising aspects you hear about from time to time. Not that long ago, I heard that Al Capone set up soup kitchens and helped to introduce pasteurised milk into schools.
He was a very community-orientated person and also a murderer.
That's right. I've yet to research this further to see if it's worth the full episode, but still not what I picture when I think of one of the most infamous gangsters of all time. So what the history involving a well-known criminal am I referring to? I hear you ask.
Yes, Trevor, what are you referring to? Or who are you referring to? I'm everyone asking.
Well, to answer that question, we need to head to Colombia.
We're going to Colombia?
Yeah. A teenager who got his start smuggling stereos and stealing and reselling tombstones soon worked his way up to be involved in the illicit cocaine smuggling trade. By the middle of the 1980s, his cartel was the dominant criminal force in Colombia, and the tombstone stealing entrepreneur was worth around $25 billion.
That's awful.
With these resources at his disposal, Pablo Escobar ensured he lived the sort of lifestyle that would inspire portrayals of criminal masterminds for decades to come. Smuggling, extortion, corruption, bribes, and executions. All the things you would expect from someone in Escobar's position were indeed part of his enterprise. And then, of course, there were the hippopotamuses. Wait, what the history? Let me explain. A part of his very lavish lifestyle included his own private zoo housed within his 2,800-hectare estate.
Wow.
He imported exotic animals, including elephants, giraffes, and four hippos. There were three females and one male.
You idiot.
He even allowed the public to visit to look at the animals. Local schools took field trips to the drug lord's home. After Escobar's death in the early 1990s, his estate was seized and most of the animals were relocated. The exceptions were the hippos due to their size. They lived well, though. They had their own private lake, with the surrounding estate becoming overgrown with lush vegetation. With no more regular visitors, they became largely forgotten about. In 2007, some 14 years after Escobar's death, residents of the town of Antioquia called up the Environment Ministry to report a strange animal sighted in the local river. It was described as having small ears and a really big mouth.
Guess who?
Carlos Valderrama from the wildlife charity Web Conserver went to investigate and inform the very surprised locals that a hippopotamus had taken up residence. Of course, it was because of Escobar's menagerie. Given their idyllic conditions, his hippos had bred, and the growing population had expanded from their lake and into the surrounding waterways. At last count, the belief is there is approximately 80 to 100 hippopotamuses now living in Colombia, but there is a possibility of there being even more. And they are spreading, with confirmed sightings up to 250 kilometres from Escobar's not-so-humble abode. The growing population has caused concern amongst experts. Even though there has been no incidents in South America, hippos are responsible for more deaths in Africa than lion attacks. The issue has been compounded by a growing, well, affection for the ponderous animal amongst the locals. Towns are seeing a boost in tourism, with curious onlookers coming to see the beasts, and of course, purchase hippo merchandise. People even have hippo cubs as pets. When a hippopotamus was killed in 2009, there was a huge outcry, and experts have been trying to find a more humane way of controlling the population. It was an accidental killing, by the way. It wasn't a deliberate one.
Okay.
Experts are also split on the expat animals' impact on the local environment. While there is much concern about the harm they may cause to the local ecosystem, some believe they may be a positive influence. The hippos may step in to fill a hole left by the extinction of large plant-eating mammals in South America and may even be the key in ensuring hippos themselves are saved from extinction. So that is why Pablo Escobar's most enduring legacy is the humble hippopotamus. God. Definitely quite the contribution to What the History.
Those poor locals. What the hell is this?
At least if we saw a hippo down in our local creek, we would know what a hippo was.
Yeah, but well, they'd never seen one before.
But you just see one of those for the first time.
I don't think a hippo is actually indigenous to South America.
No, it's not.
Oh, it's not.
But apparently it quite likes the South American life.
And who doesn't? It's a bit too hot there for me.
Yeah.
Look, I complain when it hits summer in Brisbane. South America and I don't think we'd get on too good.
My baby does not want to go to Rio de Janeiro.
I'm sorry, our friends in Rio de Janeiro and South America. I really am. But yeah, one day I might visit.
Never say never.
Never say never. Once when we can travel again.
Yeah, well.
I want to go back to the UK so much.
And thanks for listening to What the History. We hope you've enjoyed these two bizarre bits of history.
Very bizarre and very humane.
Now, if you do want to know more, all our references are down in the podcast description, just down below.
I like this one. Pablo Escobar's hippos. A growing problem.
If you're watching this on the live stream, you're going to have to come back once the episode is posted to see those references, okay? They're not on the live stream description. And if you're wondering why I said live stream, that is because if you join the Rufus Project Presents Patreon at patreon.com/RufusProject, you'll get a whole pile of bonuses. You get early access to all our episodes, up to and including the occasional live stream us recording them. So if you also would like to check out our backlog, you can head to the Rufus Project Presents homepage at rufusproject.com, or of course subscribe to What the History on your favorite podcast app. Join us on Facebook and the What the History podcast Facebook page, and you can send us an email to WTHpod@rufusproject.com. I'm pretty sure I said that. Sorry, I didn't update everything earlier. And I'm trying to what was what? I hope that was right. It'll be in the link. There'll be a link to our email as well.
All right.
I know I'm pointing down below, like you can see it right now. You can't see it right now.
Because... stop pointing. You're so funny.
So we shall return, believe it or not.
We will. We will not leave it too far between drinks next time.
At some point in the future.
At some point in the future. And I need to write a few more What the Histories.
Yes.
Yes, that was my last one that I wrote. As I said, it was back in January. I did have a few a few that I wrote before that would have been done.
Yeah. We actually managed to get a bit of a buffer on research stories.
Yeah, I did a whole heap in about a week. It was great. Now it was really good.
Run out of the buffer.
Yeah. So I've got to write some more. So I'm going to be able to do some more research, which I love.
Research is fun.
Can I research my family tree as well?
So many topics on the list. As I was saying.
I'm not saying anything else.
We will be back with two more bizarre bits of history to make you say,
What the History? Bye.
Farewell.
Bye-bye.